Hello, and welcome to the Game Production Community Podcast. Today, we're featuring PlayerUnknown Productions art director Scott Davidson in his talk, Even Tom Hanks Thinks He's a Loser Sometimes. Scott will be talking to us about his experience with imposter syndrome throughout his career in the games industry. Scott will also share useful ways of coping with imposter syndrome, should we ever feel self-doubt throughout our journey. You can find the slides to Scott's talk in the pinned post in the event chat channel. After the talk, there will be a live Q&A session. Feel free to use the event chat channel to share your thoughts and perspectives during the talk and post your own as well as vote for questions others have posted in the event QA channel. As always, the talk is being recorded and will be published on the Game Production Podcast after the event. Our thanks go to our wonderful supporters and especially our event producer, Kaz, for making this event happen. And with that, I will be handing it over to Scott.
Hello. So yeah, I work for PlayerUnknown Productions After the talk, if people have any questions about what we're doing, we're doing some quite exciting stuff. We could talk about that. So this is a talk I did at Indigo this year, and people quite liked it. So, you know, I'll do it again. There's the title of the talk. So if people don't know, imposter syndrome has affected me throughout my entire life. And I have developed some things to cope with it. It is described as the persistent inability to believe in one's success, that one's success is deserved or has been legitimately achieved as a result of one's own efforts or skills. This manifests in like what I call the four horsemen. So, and it's not every single one of these. I don't have all of these, but if you're on the other side of it and you think somebody you're working with has it, some of these things might actually like help you identify it. Anxiety, perfectionism, self-doubt, fear of failure. I think I've probably had all of those at any one time, but not all of them at once. Yeah. And I've managed to kind of tone down the perfectionism now, kind of like just let it go. So Tom Hanks does have imposter syndrome. Here is Tom Hanks winning awards. Yeah. Two Oscars for Forrest Gump and Philadelphia, being awarded the Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama. And then at a dinner with Barack Obama and the Queen of England, they're clearly friends. He gets onto the set of every film he does and he thinks he's a fraud. He thinks that someone's going to come up to him and say, this has all been a big mistake and we don't know how you've managed to have a successful career, but you're actually rubbish. Yeah, and he really thinks that. If he can affect someone like him, then it's easy to see how he affects other people. It was first documented in a study with high achieving women in the 70s. It said while imposter syndrome is still more prevalent among women, specifically women of color, some men are also susceptible to developing this. This was the 70s. Yeah, so, you know, obviously back then men were perfect and could do no wrong. We know different now. A recent study found that 75% of female executives across industries have experienced it, and another study, 70% of the US population have experienced these feelings. It's like it's not a small thing. So when I was young, my father left and he decided he didn't want to be a dad and he went to America when I was one. I don't think that's really affected me at all. I don't have any contact with him. I don't feel like I lost anything. I don't feel like he left because it was anything to do with me, and I actually got a new dad. I got a stepdad within a couple of years, so that was okay. But he was a chef, so I thought, it's the only thing I've got connected to, I'll be a chef. I didn't know what I was going to do when I was a kid. I thought, and that's what I thought chefs did, yeah. So I went and worked in a kitchen, and that was what I got. The guy was angry, he sweated profusely, he shouted at people. It was not fun, yeah. I was 13. This was not going to be my career. But I was really bad at school, like really, I had no interest in school whatsoever. I would sit in the classrooms and I would look around at lots of the other kids sort of diligently working, and they had their heads down and they would like doing their work, and I just couldn't. I had no interest in it whatsoever. So I was like, well, what am I going to do? But I was good at art, so I decided, oh, I'll go to art college. So that's the art college in 1992 when I went, and that's it now. So it kind of is, you can see it's the same building, they've given it a bit of a facelift. And I did a foundation course, which is basically gives you foundation in kind of art history and color theory and anatomy and and all the kind of foundations of you need to be an artist. Yeah, and I think it's kind of beneficial when you're interviewing people that actually people have that, because a lot of people just go straight to game art and they miss some crucial stuff. So while I was there and I was a kid, I really got into like Airfix models, yeah. And then I got into Warhammer, painting Warhammer. I never played the game. Got into, like, could I do this for like a job? Could I like make kind of models? Turns out you could do that. So I was like, I'm going to do that then. I'm going to make models. I'm going to go to like sort of work at kind of big film studios and do special effects. So I went to a university in Kent, which is very near Shepton Studios, where they film kind of quite big films. And then what happened is a little film called Jurassic Park came out halfway through by my course, and it was like death for the industry. Film industry moves really fast, so they were just they were like, right, it's computers now. This is the future. So any kind of skills when we graduated were kind of null and void because everybody was moving over to computers. So what it is, I bought a computer, a Pentium, with like 60 mega RAM, and I learned 3D. It kind of looked like that. I didn't have speakers. I used 3D theory in DOS, which was like a crazy tool. Like it's not a tool you'd want to use now. It's insane. I learned in a bunch of other programs as well. And then while I was applying for jobs in the film industry and getting no reaction at all, I then played Quake, and I was like, this is cool, this is super cool. So I was like, well, I could do this as a job, I could be an artist. And then like I started applying for jobs video games. And it worked way better. I got a job pretty quickly in a place called Blitzkrieg Studios. But my parents were still like, oh, maybe you shouldn't do this. Maybe you should find a normal job. How could you do this as a job? How could you make video games? What do you do? Like, do you put the video games in the boxes, the discs in the boxes? Is that your job? I was like, no. But then when I started telling them that I got a salary, it was way better. So imposter syndrome, where does it come from? Well, how do you kind of get it? Well, some researchers believe it has its labels parents give to their kids. My stepdad, his father was a sergeant major in the army, and he was very strict. So he was very strict to me, and he would call me an idiot sometimes. And I think that kind of like did a little bit to my self-esteem. But I don't think he was doing it on purpose. I think I was probably doing stupid things. I was a kid. Another theory is that it's actually like parents actually making their kids feel superior, and the kids underneath kind of knowing that it's not great, and that it's not real. So, but there are other theories as well. So I got my job by sending floppy disks out. Like, that's what you did. You would put your work on a floppy disk and like send it in the post to people, and they would receive it in the mail. When I was applying for jobs, there were some people who were very angry. There was one guy who phoned me up, and I don't know, he was having a bad day, and he told me all my work was bad. Like, he said, you should just give up now, and there's no point in doing it. And I was like, that's kind of crazy that he said that. And I kind of persevered. So I didn't feel imposter syndrome then. It can affect you then. Yeah. So like lesson one is, if you don't believe in, if others don't believe in you, they can really in a fool, that it sits at the back of your brain and will sort of say, you can't do this. So I got my job at Blitz Games, and I stayed there for like 15 years. But that's when the imposter syndrome kicked in, because I like got a job then in the industry, like got my dream. And then it was like, oh, this is really bad. They're going to find out really quickly that I can't do this. But it didn't happen. And then it settles down. But then what happens is you get a promotion. I got positive feedback from people. So this is lesson two. Without positive feedback from managers, peers, or subordinates, you know, it can continue and resurface later. You need, like, it doesn't have to be constant praise, but people, if someone does good work, call it out. So I worked on pretty much every console up until sort of like PlayStation 4, every platform. Very kind of like intensive company contracted work for publishers. And we were good at sort of what I say is like the hardest thing is actually shipping a game. Like, people can have great ideas and you can kind of make great art and do great code, but shipping it, that's the hard thing. I did PC as well. That's my PC. But then at some point, I kind of like a parapet, and I kind of was interested in this particular project. And my boss came to me and said, maybe you could just head that project up. And I was like, whoa. I freaked out. I was like, oh, no way. Because this will be the moment. You know, I'm comfortable now. I kind of like got my head down. I'm doing work and people think I'm good. But if I actually like do this, that's it. That's it. That's what's going to happen. They will find out then. So I backed off from it really quickly. And then a couple of years later, what happened is that I was on a project and the guy who was working on the project, the art director, what he wanted to do and what the management said was that he can do the cool, interesting work and you could do the management work because you want to like get a promotion. So you could do the management work, the paperwork and Excel charts and project planning, and he can just like be an artist. And I was like, that's kind of not good. So I said no to that. And then during the project, it started falling apart and they just came to me and said, will you start doing it, please? And I was kind of forced into a corner then to like, okay, well, I have to do this now. I literally, there was the smallest room in the office and the head of production took me into this tiny little box room and just said, just start doing it today. I'm sick of it. So I did. And it seemed to work. People listened to what I said, which is crazy. But very stressful. Like, I remember the first project I headed up, I made loads of mistakes. I listened to some people whose priorities were based on kind of the bottom line instead of trying to get a good product. And it actually causes problems because people would come to me and say, oh, we want to do the outsourcing. We want to use the outsourcing studio that's the cheapest. And I would say, well, it's not going to be good. And they were like, yeah, it'll be fine. So I'd go, okay, then fine. Because I was inexperienced. And then it would come back to bite us. So at this point now, yeah, like I wouldn't do that. Then Blitz Games went under and we all got made redundant, but I was working on a game for Rebellion called Nazi Zombie Army 2. Yeah. And they were like, well, you might as well just come from work for us because we want to finish the project. So I did that. But I was commuting from where I lived in Birmingham with kids and a wife to Oxford, which is a good 2-hour commute, and I was driving. You can only do that for so long. So then I was like, okay, well, what do I want to do? So I wrote down what I thought was important to me, and these were the four things: creativity, ownership, challenge, and inspiration. And luckily, I met a friend of mine at a pub. Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So if you're going to do that, if you're going to like go for what you want to do next, you've got to interview the employer while they're interviewing you. It's like really important. People like that, actually. I quite like that. So I went for a drink with a friend of mine, and he was working for Facebook Studios, which I thought for some reason was in like LA or something like that, but it's actually in this tiny block switch in the West Midlands, which is like 10 miles from my house, like really, really close. And he said it's really cool, there's loads of freedom, there's zero hire, it's set up very much like Valve is, and we're doing some really cool work. They were working on a game that very early access and it looked really bad. It was just all store-bought Unity assets. It was awful. So I got talking to the CEO, Gary Newman, and he said, I haven't really been in the industry. I don't even know what an art director does. So I don't know why I would need one. I was like, okay, right. I'm going to take some screenshots of your game. And I'm going to show you the screenshots. And then I'm going to take them away on holiday. And I'm going to paint over them. And I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to show you what I think the game should look like. So I did that and sent them to him 2 weeks later when I got back from my holiday. And he was like, okay, I clearly see there's a point to it now. So we talked and we started I started working together at Facebook Studios. And I did that for like nearly 5 years, and we got to the point where Rust was, but that was when it started, 2014. It looked bad, and then when I left, it looked way better. But at that point, I was like, well, I've kind of done everything I need to do. There's no real challenge, and that's the kind of priority for me, is that top one was challenge. So I started looking around again for something else to do. So lesson four is, like, a security blanket is a slow death. Yeah. Because as someone who feels like an imposter, it's really easy to just kind of be comfortable, because you'll no, the problems won't come up, because you're kind of contained within this space that is kind of safe, and you don't challenge yourself, and then your career doesn't move forward. So you have to do it, and but it's a hard thing to do. So I started looking around again, and I found another studio. So there's a book that people should read, The Proven Path of Unstoppable Ideas, Better and Faster, by Jeremy Gutjahr. He's really good. It's really good. It'll help a lot with kind of what you want to do in your life. Here's his kind of, like, the important things. He separates people into kind of farmers and hunters. So your farmer is the person who kind of sits. So you get some success, you go, ah, okay, well, what we'll do now is we'll just kind of keep planting the same crop, and we'll maybe tweak, the feed we give it, and we might get a higher yield, but we will maximize our profits, and we'll minimize the cost and the risk. But eventually, that will end. Whereas the hunter searches for something new, and is fine with destroying what came before. Obviously, you don't want to destroy what came before your career, but being able to let it go. You learn stuff, let the last place you worked go, and move on. And the imposters find that hard to do. George Carlin's a really good example of this. George Carlin, he would do this on a yearly basis. He would write a set that he was going to go out and tour with. He would hone the jokes to perfection. He would use audiences to kind of make the jokes better and better and better. And then he would have this beautiful set. And then he would work on it for a year. He would do it on the tour, and then at the end of that tour, when the tour was finished, he would throw all the material away, everything, and he would never go back to it. And then he would start again, and he would delve deeper into his subconscious. He would think about his fears and go further into kind of, like, where the comedy was. And he did that every year. And in fact, if you look at kind of like how the comedy industry is now, most comedians kind of do the same thing. The best ones do. They don't keep telling the same jokes again and again. They come up with new material every year. So it's really good. So, like, the change is how you grow, and the imposter finds that hard. So then I found another job at Abstraction, which is where I find myself in Holland. And this was like a big challenge, because Ralph, like, people know Ralph, he's got a really big thing he wants to do, and it's super ambitious. And technology is kind of not yet at the point where it's kind of see it to its full potential, but it will get there, and I think it'll be amazing. So that's what kind of got me over here. And I had a great time there. So, like, this is what happens a lot with imposters, is you'll have a bad day. A couple of things will happen. So you'll have a bad conversation with someone. You might make a mistake, and someone tells you off for it, and you'll just crumble, and it'll take you ages to kind of pull yourself up. And actually, if you were to tell someone what happened that day, they'd be like, that doesn't sound so bad, but in your head, it sounds really bad. So the best thing here to do is to tell people. So I was really happy at Abstraction Games. I think, like, for me, Ralph is one of the best leaders I've ever worked for. He is not afraid to tell you if you've done good work, and to actually show his true emotion of, like, if he's surprised by something you've done, or if he feels proud. And for someone like for an imposter, that's like a big deal, to actually to have that reinforced. And he did reinforce it a lot. But then this year, well, last year, at the end of last year, I was approached on LinkedIn, and I was asked, hey, would you like to come and work for us? And I was told what the work they were doing, and I was like, scared, really scared. I was like, this is hard stuff. I have no idea how I'm gonna do this. So I did it. So I was like, well, I've got to do it. Yeah, this, it's that moment where what you have is you have like fear in your stomach and also excitement. It's pretty much the same feeling. Excitement and fear are kind of the same feeling. Yeah, so you're afraid, but you're also excited. So that's where I am now. As you can see, yeah, the same chemicals, they're the same chemicals. So you just have to realize that, like, yeah, you're afraid, but you're also excited. So my tips, there's a new one in here as well. So like this personal professional, the stuff that people can do to help you and stuff you can do to help yourself. A lot of it is to get out of your comfort zone. So I was, for a lot of my life, I was quite introverted, quite quiet. And I made a conscious effort to make friends with people who really weren't. And it was really hard to start with because I was like, oh God, they're so big and loud. And I would go home from a night out and just be like tired. But eventually you kind of like, you can change and kind of, you can grow with it. Take courses if you feel you're stupid. Yeah. Try new foods and activities to broaden your horizons. Like a lot of times it's just about having interesting things and embarrassing things to say to people. And the more experiences you have, the more people, and the more honest you are with people, the more authentic self you are, the more people will actually like you because they see that you're willing to actually like tell them things that for you could be quite embarrassing, but also are funny. Keep a diary. Or a minimum record of your achievements so you can look back on it. This is something like people who go to the gym and do exercise will do. So if you're doing kind of weights, you'll write down a little book. Okay, I lifted this much and it felt like this. And then if you have a bad day, you're like, oh, you don't want to go. Oh, am I making any progress at all? You look back on that little book. This is really, I've made a real difference. And for the imposter, it's great because you could look back and you go, wow, I am good because look at all these cool things I did. And then a professional level, find a mentor. It doesn't have to be someone from the same industry. It doesn't have to be someone from the same company, but someone who kind of has got more experience than you and has gone through problems and can give you advice and help you. And then we're willing to invest your time. And you'd be surprised that some people, a lot of people will be willing to invest their time in you. It's really surprising. And then like working in an environment with people who prioritize positive reinforcement and honesty. There was recently something I read where they were saying how there are two different types of working environments. There are working environments where people are praised for results and it doesn't matter if you step on other people to get there. That doesn't matter. Yeah. And that becomes quite a toxic environment. And then the other environment is that we don't succeed unless we all succeed. And as for me, as a manager, as a director, it's my job to facilitate other people's greatness. Yeah, to get out of their way, to make sure they've got the resources they need, make sure they've got the support they need, make sure the team is working harmoniously, and everyone gets on. And just step back and go, okay, you do it. You're professionals. The new lesson I've got, which is I watched a TED talk about imposter syndrome, and it was really good. It's a TEDx talk, so not as cool as a TED book, but it was still pretty good. And one of the things she said in there, this is Lou Solomon, an American broadcaster. She was like, name the demon. It's this little guy or girl in your head that says you're an idiot, you're a loser. They don't find out. Name it and give it a persona and a face. What she did is she gave the imposter, the bad one, a face, and she called it Miss Vader. Yeah, but then she created another character in her head who would tell off like a good and bad demon on your shoulder, and the helpful one was kind of like a sassy southern lady, like who would just be like, oh no, she can do it, you go girl. Now, my solution is slightly different than that. I just found someone who I thought he was kind of like a silly bad guy. And this is the guy. There was a TV show in like 70s called It Ain't Half Hot. And there was this guy, he's a great actor, Windsor Davis. And he played the Sergeant Major, Bryn Williams. And he would just run around, he would just walk around shouting at people. And he was a kind of pathetic character, really, because he no one would do what he told them. And in my head, for the last couple of months, I've been doing this. And it actually works, because I give him that face. I give, every time in my head, I say, you can't do this. You're going to fail. It's him saying it, and it makes me laugh. And it dampens down those feelings quite a lot. So you can find ways of doing this. That's kind of it. If you have any questions, then you can ask me some questions.
That was great. Thanks so much for sharing your experiences. So you and I have talked about our imposters at length, including our extensive individual reflections and analyses of our feelings both in and after the moment. And it's been a relief to commiserate. That's also why I wanted you to talk to the audience here, because we've got a lot of imposters among us. It's a topic that's been surfacing in the Discord very regularly. And just knowing that there are people out there that have been in the industry for years and still feel it is sort of a, in a sense, it's a relief to hear. I was just talking to a senior leader at EA, and she also expressed that she still goes through it, even though she's been in the industry for 20 years. So thank you so much for opening up, for being willing to share, for being vulnerable like that. In the meantime, while we are getting our live Q&A underway, I want to remind everyone to please vote for questions in the channel and make sure to also add whatever questions you have. So for all of you imposters out there, Scott's here right now. Right now you have a chance to ask. So go right ahead and post whatever questions you have. So let me hop in there, because we do already have a few questions that were posted during the talk. I'm going to go by the amount of upvotes that something has. So for now, we'll probably get around to almost everything that's being posted in here, but eventually I'll start going from top to bottom. So the first question I want to ask is, when struggling with imposter syndrome, is it acceptable to express this to your team / colleague / employer?
So the first question was, is it okay to tell people? Yes, definitely. As I said, like, when I downplayed it, I was like, it's a first world problem, really. Come on. Like, really? Highly successful people, like, thinking that they're frauds? That's just, you know. But actually, it really can affect your career. It really can affect your decision making, because you just are afraid of what's going to potentially happen. And I don't tend to look back and kind of go, I should have made those decisions, or we should have made those decisions. Don't regret anything. I tend to just move forward positively. But doesn't discount that those things still happen. Yeah, and that you would make different decisions if that little voice in your head wasn't as loud. Yeah, so telling people about it is a really good thing, because you tend to find that other people feel the same. Yeah, you can tackle it together.
Absolutely agree. I think for me, even acknowledging it to other people has, in a sense, been a little bit cathartic, where it's just felt like a relief. And I have that not just with being an imposter, but also just acknowledging failure, admitting that I've made mistakes, where the buildup of discomfort in my gut gets so bad that it renders me immobile in some cases. And then as soon as I've confronted that, as you put it, demon, I would have called it a demon myself as well. As soon as I verbalized it to someone, especially the person I most dread telling, that weight is lifted. So I wouldn't just say that it's acceptable. It can also be a way of dealing with it, like processing the fear, the discomfort, because it airs it. And suddenly the response turns out not to be as bad as you feared.
Yeah. And the thing is, we also will downplay it, because, like, we don't work in the most important industry in the world. Yeah, we're not curing cancer. Yeah. So we go, well, we're doing something important. So, you know, aren't be as important either. You know, what are we actually doing, really? But it's not like that. Yeah. We have to approach everything with mental health in a serious way, no matter what you work in. If you had imposter syndrome and you were a train driver or an airline pilot, yeah, the consequences of you failing are quite big. But on a personal level, it's we're all humans and we need to kind of be honest.
We're not saving lives every day. So if we make a mistake, then we can probably fix it.
And actually, we should make mistakes. Mistakes are good.
Exactly. That's how we learn and grow, right? That's what you said.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to the next question. This was a very popular upvoted question as well, but I think you kind of already answered it, especially now that you've moved to PlayerUnknown Productions. So have you ever applied for a role despite imposter syndrome leading you to believe that you would not be skilled enough?
There was something that I was going to add into this, and then I was talking to Natalia about it afterwards, and she said, don't add that in, because it's actually bullshit. There was some research apparently done years ago where they said that men and women approach applying for jobs very differently. So women will look at job description, and they will only apply for a job if they think they can of that. Yeah. Whereas men will just look at it and go, I'll do 20% of that, and I'll blag it. I'll just kind of just go for anywhere and I'll tour my way into it. That's actually bullshit. So if you ever read that anywhere, it's bullshit. It's been debunked. It's not like real research. But yeah, the question is how do you apply for those things when you think that you can't do them? There's no harm in applying for things. And if you manage to kind of get in, because people review this CV and they'll kind of see if there's any gaps. And if you get to the interview stage, then that's a good sign. Generally, I find that if there are actually gaps in people's skill set, and they feel that I can't do this, if it's part of the job and I can't do it, then how am I going to get the job? When in fact, actually, for me, it's way more about personality. And I'm more interested in finding someone with the right personality and even trained skills, for sure. Yeah, it's the personality that comes. So I would say you have to always think. I don't know what people are really looking for, because I'm going for a job description. And if you go on the internet, everyone just copies one of those job descriptions. Yeah. Very rare that you find a kind of unique job description somewhere. People just kind of cut and paste stuff from, it's the same thing. And who you read the job description, it's like, well, yeah, I can do some of this stuff, but can I do all of it? No. But then that's not what people are looking for, I don't think. You don't really how you counter it, really. If you read a job description and you think, oh god, I don't think I can do any of this. But I'm really excited about this company or the potential of working in this. Apply anyway and say it in the interview, because you may find that kind of honesty. For me, it works. People are honest in the interview and say, you know what? I don't think I'm right for this role, but I think I could really contribute. And then you go, okay, well, how do you think you could contribute? It's people get hung up on trying to fit the job description, and they also get hung up with the prestige of whatever company potentially they might work for. Because as you see, even the biggest companies internally, some of them are an absolute mess. Yeah, and everyone makes mistakes.
I think especially if you're someone like you or I looking for challenge at the core of our jobs, then we kind of have to admit that we must apply to roles that sound too intimidating or too above our heads, because that's where we find challenge.
Yeah. So it's interesting. People might have seen the news, but we've had a new person join the studio as a as the he's an advisor to start with for 6 months, and we'll see how that goes after 6 months. He was in on Tuesday. Now, me and there's and I know a couple of other people. Someone new coming in at a very high level, someone who's kind of a known name in the industry coming in. Some people get alarmed by that, yeah. And I said to people, like in a meeting, I said, because the people were worried, like, what's he going to do? What's he going to do? And I was, I tried to say to everyone, he's just coming in to kind of help. He just wants to get to know everyone and then kind of try and work and get everything working. And I said to people, I said, you think it's that scene from Office Space. Now, hopefully some people have seen that film, Office Space. And there's a scene in it where these two guys come in and they interview everyone in the company, yeah? And they ask them, what do you do? And it's basically they're coming into kind of like downsize, yeah? To find out who's not really needed in the industry, in the company, and give them redundancy. And people thought that's what it was going to be. And it totally wasn't. And me saying that I thought people were thinking this, they were like, yeah, we totally thought that. So there's already, you have people who kind of felt like they were bosses, because these are super talented people. These are really talented people. And they thought, oh my God, I'm going to get cut because someone very, very big is coming in. And in fact, when you he came in and everyone was like, oh, he's just really cool. And he was just like, talk like everybody else. And he generally wants to help and help us succeed. So you have to again talk about it, yeah. You'll find that other people have it too.
Something that I do to help me with that, and I will acknowledge up front that this is super intimidating. I actually just did it today. Is that I will put people on a pedestal subconsciously. I will put especially senior leadership that I look up to on a pedestal, and that will inevitably influence the opinion that I form about whatever they say. And what I do to remedy that is, as soon as I've joined a company and I recognize that feeling in myself, I go and talk to the person. And like in my preparations for that call, during the startup of that call, my heart is racing, I'm sweating, I'm shaking. And then when the chat opens, I realize they're just a person and they have their own fears. They have they have a little bit of an imposter of their own, if it's not just an actual very big imposter and a demon of their own. And for me, approaching people that I look up to in that way, helps me humanize them. It helps me put them in perspective. It helps me do my job better. So it's yes, it's scary. Yes, it's intimidating. But I've only found benefit in actually confronting it that way. So it's the same as what you're sharing about this guy coming into the office and then actually showing up as a human being.
Yeah, yeah, and admitting to that, like, yeah, he was like, yeah, I've made so many mistakes in my career. He'd be like, you know, and I sometimes went up front and said, look, you know what? We're going to do this and we're all going to make mistakes, but it's fine. The pedestal thing is a really, really big deal. And I think that's what people did with this guy. They were like, oh yeah, he's a big name. So, you know, wow, this is serious. But he just came and was like, just praised everyone and was like, God, it works so good. Yeah, and they were like, really? Well, yeah. So you just don't.
All right. So this question was asked very recently and immediately got 9 upvotes. So it's a popular one. Imposter syndrome can make me feel like I need to keep up with my peers. How do I balance the constant pursuit of improving in my craft without actually burning myself out?
You want that perfectionism. It's one of the traits, because you think, well, I've got to be better than everyone. I've got to work harder than everyone to actually achieve the same results as everyone else. And it is a hard balance to strike. You've got to learn to switch off. And I think I struggle with this so much. Like, the next week and a half, I'm going to be on holiday, but yeah, I'm still doing interviews, because like some people apply, and I'm like, I can't let that wait. Yeah, because I want to interview that person. You need to, as much as possible, you need to actually switch off and actually take it at your own pace, and seek assistance as well from probably the people that actually the most you feel that you're that they're the ones you're kind of not competing with, but the ones that sort of like, oh, they're higher up than me, or I think their work is better than mine. People love, mostly, some people hate it, but the people you want to work with are the people that when you say, I love what you did there, how did you do this? Can you just sit with me for half an hour and break down how you did that? Especially in art, people love that. They'll be like, yeah, let me talk about this work that I like everyone thought was cool and tell you how I did it. And then the ones who are like, no, they're the ones that are kind of like, I can't let you know what I know because then you beat me. Yeah. I worked with another art director once and he would never hire anyone that was better than him. He always hired artists that were slightly worse than him because he didn't want anyone taking his job. Whereas I was like, I'm actively hiring people who scare me. Who I think, yeah, in 5 years' time, they're gunning for my job, definitely. And I look at kind of all the people I've employed, and they all do well because you've got to approach it. Balance is hard. How I do it when I, like, at the moment it's hard because we're trying to build a team. But how I do it generally is surround yourself with people in your personal life that don't make games, yeah? Have some friends that don't make games, have no interest in games, so you have that actual time to switch off. Most of my friends, when I first started out, they were all in the games industry. And it didn't help. And then I moved into an apartment, shared an apartment with a bunch of random strangers, and it was cool. Because like I met loads of different people. And if you feel that you're struggling, then you have to talk to your line manager, your boss, and say, like, I feel I don't know how to actually balance this. And I feel like I'm struggling. And what happened probably is they were like, what do you mean you're struggling? You're awesome. Yeah. And because it is a lot of it is just in your head. And by actually saying out loud, it dissipates it. Yeah. And people will react positively to it. If you're in the right company. Yeah.
And to build on that a little bit, I would say that the average company, the good companies, they don't hire you to be a clone of your peers. They hire you because of you. They hire you for your perspective. They hire you for your impact. And that means that you are complementing others. So develop yourself in the direction that you're interested in. That's also of use to the company. And don't try to develop yourself to mimic others. Acknowledge, and this is really hard. This is something that I actively struggle with every day. But at some point, you'll have to acknowledge to yourself that you can't possibly know everything. So it helps to try and free yourself from that expectation of perfection. And then strive for excellence. Prioritize what's most important by constantly checking and reevaluating with leadership and other perspectives from those around you to focus on what adds the most value. And then at that point, you are doing everything that you can to keep improving yourself, to keep learning. And you'll find that, especially if you then, like Scott says, keep asking leadership, peers, you'll find that you're probably doing quite all right. All right, moving on to the next question. All right, so how do you manage the imposter feeling when you're surrounded by a team that is vastly more experienced than you are? Sort of tying into the previous question.
Yeah. The thing is, you got to remember is that when people are hiring, it's a really big deal because if you hire someone wrong, everyone suffers because everyone has to deal with that, yeah? And so people are really careful. And you've beaten everybody else to get that job. And you might not know, I actually will tell people. When people come for the job and they've got the job, I'll tell them, like, this is how many people applied for this. And you beat them all. Yeah. In fact, like, I employed a second concept artist, like in the first couple of months of this year. And we went through a process where we had a bunch of really senior concept artists from big companies. And the problem with concept artists is they can't show their actual work on ArtStation. They can show the finished pieces, but what we want to see their mind. We want to see the working ideas. And that, because these days you have to have sign off of what you release on ArtStation. It's done. So we decided to do a test. And like with this particular person we hired, we were like, yeah, the work's pretty good. She destroyed the competition. Yeah. Absolutely destroyed the competition. Just her work was just vastly superior to everyone else's. And I told her that. And I tell everybody that, yeah, when they join. And I'm doing a presentation and I'm going to put up the test that she did. And it'll embarrass her a little bit more. But it's an important thing to actually, for us as managers, to actually make sure that the people who join are aware that the reason why we hired them is because they're really good. And hiring someone that wasn't really good isn't an option. So in the experience thing, and you feeling like you're inexperienced, I know that you're feeling where you might go in a meeting and you kind of might not know what people are talking about. You don't get the crux of what people are talking about. And you kind of go, I don't want to say that. Say it. Yeah. Just say it. Because you know what? Some other people might not know what they're talking, what being talked about either. And they might go, yeah, I don't really know what's going on here. Like it happens all the time. Like I did it. Like I was working at Abstraction, and we used this time tracking software. Yeah, where because we did contract work, we wanted to make sure that we could budget for everything. So if we were working on a contracted project, everyone tracked their time. So they wrote down what they did from minute to minute in the day, and then we could work out, okay, well, did this project make money? Yeah, and I hadn't been introduced to it at all. And this was 4 months in, and we had an exec meeting, and people were talking about it. And I just said, I have a question. And they said, what? And I was like, what is Clockify? And they all laughed, and they were like, what do you mean, what is Clockify? And I was like, well, I haven't got it. No one gave it to me. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah. And no one went, oh, my God, you're a loser. They thought there was an oversight. Someone had forgotten to kind of, like, introduce me to it. And then it, like, got sorted out. So those feelings of feeling like, okay, these people are way more experienced than me. They don't have time for bullshit, so they employ you because you're really good. Yeah, that's it. And that's the only thing you can do is you can keep that in mind, is that if they didn't think I was good, they wouldn't have given me the job. Something they're not just filling numbers.
And something that I would add to that is that if you perceive the team around you to be vastly more experienced than that, you are in an exceptionally lucky position, because that means that you have a team around you that you can learn a lot from. So lean into it, ask them how they got where they are and what they recommend you do to get there. People like talking about how they do what they do, and they probably feel like an imposter about it as well. So you are going to be helping them while you do it. And then after you have opened them up to talk about an area that's probably also going to be a little bit vulnerable to you, to them, make sure to ask them what they think you add, how you complement them, and what they value in you, because they're probably going to value things that you don't realize that you're adding. Like something that I realized about myself is I organize things because I can't stop myself. And I had to discover that that's something that not everyone feels comfortable doing, only after they complimented me for it, for something that felt trivial to me. So it's like after you are already in the kind of relationship with someone that you can exchange feedback, ask them for it. What makes you valuable to the team? And then lean into that. All right, moving on to the next question. Maybe it's just my own experience with imposter syndrome, but what is your advice and or suggestion for when to financially invest in a potential education gap? One of my biggest fears is putting in money for something that I've overthought about buying just to realize the value gained might not have been worth it.
Well, the first thing is, does the company you work for value the things you want to learn? Yeah. And if they do, then and they think it's worth it, they'll probably pay for it. And that's it doesn't fair. Have to be some kind of system. Yeah. Sometimes you just ask your manager, you ask your kind of superior and just be like, okay, I was going to do this. Just, do you think this is, you know, something that would benefit? And they'll be like, yeah, cool. Yeah, just expense it or we'll build it in. And you'll find that if you're working the right place, people will be more than happy to help. And make it something that is an official thing.
I suspect this question is also especially relevant for folks that are students or that are just about to transition into the industry. So people that aren't yet employed within the game industry, any specific advice for those situations?
So people are moving into the games industry from graduation and this is their first job.
For example, yes.
Yeah. Ask for more money. Yeah. Here's one thing, right? And this can apply here where I work, ask for more money. There's generally, like everywhere you go, there's a graduate level. Just ask for 2K more. People will go, okay. And then you can use that 2K to invest in what you want. Yeah. People like negotiation. People like people who are willing to actually say, I think I'm worth this. Yeah. And that took me a long time to realize that. The first time I walked into someone's office and was offered a job and they said to me, so what can I do for you, Scott? And I was like, what do you mean? Like what do you want from this? And I was like, well, I guess like pay me money for doing the job. What he's actually saying is, how much do you want? And do you want stock? Do you want a share of the company? And afterwards, I was like, people said, that's what he meant. I was like, oh my God, why didn't I say anything? You have to ask. Yeah. The being a graduate is always the scary thing. But I can tell you from experience that I'm very careful hiring graduates. Very careful, because for them and for the team as well, because graduates more than anything can, if they're not the right fit, can cause problems, because the pressure it'll break them really quickly once it kind of quits, and if they've got the wrong personality, it'll show really quickly. So most companies will be really careful for what they do.
All right, Scott, we're already at the top of the hour. We do still have a few more questions. So if you have time, we could keep going
a little longer.
But...
Yeah,
all right, great. Okay, great. So then next question. As a PM and founder/CEO of my own video game studio, I'm always fearing that what we're creating, in this case, our active project, isn't as good as we think that it is. Personally, they feel that sometimes the project keeps growing faster every day, and that's very intimidating. So the staff and the dev team believe in the project, but they do sometimes feel that the work in general isn't good enough. So if you have any advice not to sabotage yourself, themselves, and the project at the same time, just for getting scared.
Yeah, this is like the whole team has got imposter syndrome, a collective imposter syndrome. You think, you know, and people are possibly, do you feel that they're like, oh my, this isn't as good as we think it is, you know? People who are kind of investors or people who look at these games, who look at games to see if they're worth investing in, they're they will give your time for free sometimes. They'll take meetings, yeah? And you can show them what you've got and you can ask them. And they'll give you really honest feedback because they have nothing to gain. They have no skin in the game. They're not affiliated with you at all. They're not going to make money or lose money from it. So they'll tell you exactly what they think of it. So you get feedback from peers from my experience, you sometimes don't know what you've got on your hands. Yeah. So for example, so I worked with Mike Bithell. He was at Blitz Games and he was making Thomas was alone at the same time in his spare time. At the same time as the company were actually developing a kind of online sort of indie portal for selling games, yeah. And he kind of he got the demo together and he kind of finished it. And he offered it to the company that they could buy off him. And they went, nah, not interested, we don't get it. Yeah, these are like people who kind of spent 30 years in the industry and had real success. And they were like, nah. So he left and made it himself. And, you know, there you go. Because at the end of the day, if you don't believe in yourself, like no one else is going to. This is what we should teach our children. Yeah. When you have children, is that like mummy loves you and daddy loves you, but the rest of the world couldn't give a shit. Yeah. So sometimes that's a really good thing because people will give you their honest feedback. You gotta just pick the right people, really.
And something that I would say also, and this is the hardest in the most vulnerable moment when you're terrified, but it's also the most beneficial right at that time, is to find diverse perspectives. So find the most different opinion that you could possibly find and ask them for their thoughts, for their perspective on what you're making, because they can probably add something. They're not going to break it down, tear it down. If they're a genuine person interested in this helping you, they're just going to provide you with feedback that you can use to get a better grip on what you're making, to be focused on what should have priority, if worst case, it's going to help you reaffirm what you're already doing. So leverage those diverse perspectives that you can surround yourself with. You have them at your fingertips with all the Discord servers that are out there these days.
Yeah. It also, the thing is well, it's like actually put it in people's hands as well. Don't be afraid to actually just release something that's kind of unfinished as a demo, or just kind of show it to the public, because they'll be really honest with you about what they think. And there's a market for everything. So you find it, like, some people who are like, I mean, this is the thing, like with Rust, when we were making Rust, there was a point where it was going to get canned. This is not going to work. And then we did what's called, I can't remember the name of it, it's a Dutch auction, I think it's called, where you kind of like, people bid for so many keys and then the bids go up and the bids went crazy. People were going to spending loads of money on these keys and be like, oh God, this is actually pretty good. So you just don't know, yeah. And some people just won't get it. That's inevitable.
I agree, and you know that's also something that you will have to learn, because the feedback that you're going to get in that relatively safe space before release is going to hurt a lot less than once you've actually released it into the wild, and players with opinions with a capital O are going to be pelting you with their thoughts. That was good practice.
Yeah. This is why open development can be a good way of working, because even if something is in kind of an incubation, players will be like, this is what I'm looking for. Some people will be like, because people have got ideas in their heads of games that they really want and just don't exist. And if you find those people, they'll be like, oh my God, I really want that game. And they'll follow you. And you give them feedback, you give them updates of what's happening, and they'll come along for the ride. Because I spent most of my career doing all these games in kind of isolation, which is what still most of the rest of the industry does. You come up with an idea for a game, get a bunch of funding together, it's all secret, super secret. And you do that for like 2 or 3 years, if not more. And you might release the teaser trailer, and some people go, ooh, and some people go, meh. And then eventually you release the game, and either people care, it does quite well, or it does amazingly, or people don't care. And you didn't know. You only had those tiny little points where you could actually say, you could get feedback on whether something was good or bad, and that's just not enough. So open development, especially for indies, is a really good idea, because it will also give you real positives as well, because you will have people in the games community, players, who will be like, I'm so looking forward to this. And just a couple of people saying that will give you a sense that, okay, maybe we've got something here.
Yeah. All right. So completely different perspective. If you are the manager, how can you tell that a team member is experiencing imposter syndrome, especially if that person is very introverted or doesn't really talk about their feelings?
It's a trust thing. You have to give that employee, you have to be, I become the sort of the confessor. Yeah. So I spent a long time saying to people, you tell me stuff in confidence, it is not going to leave this room. Unless you say, Scott, this particular thing I've told you in confidence, I want it to be actioned. But I don't want, and you'll be like, I want it to be actioned, but I don't want anyone to know that it was me. Or actually, I want people to know that this is me, and this is a problem I've got. And everything else you should keep to yourself. You should keep it in a bubble. And over time, people will trust you. And with the quiet people, the worst thing to do is have those 6 monthly or quarterly appraisals. Yeah. Because they may end up talking in those appraisals, but all the stuff they want to say, they've been bottling up for 3 or 4 months, if not 6 months. And then they come into the room and they're like, whoa, and it all comes out. And you're like, whoa, where's this all coming from? If you're having regular actually calls with people, you're having kind of one-to-ones with people. They don't have to be one-to-ones where you're actually talking about work. It's just half an hour where you just go, how's it going? What did you do this weekend? And you talk about random TV show you've been watching, yeah? Or you just get to know people that way. And eventually people will trust you. And as long as you kind of, you reward that trust with being the person who has always got their back, they will be really honest about their lives to you. And you can then, a lot of times you can really see some problems coming, and then you can make sure it gets fixed quicker. Yeah.
All right. And this question, for me, it hurts a little bit inside to have to ask this, because I know that the answer might be painful, but how do you know the difference between imposter syndrome and actually being incompetent at the task you have before you?
Yeah. Well, if you feel that you're actually incompetent, yeah, you'll find out really quickly, especially in this industry. And you will end up with warnings, and you'll end up being pulled up for disciplinaries, and you'll end up with like having to be assigned a mentor and all the kind of things that come with problem people. It'll happen. The thing is, with most of the imposters, it just doesn't happen. Because these are competent people, yeah. The imposter, the people who are incompetent don't even know they're incompetent. They think they're awesome, yeah. I mean, we could mention some people who became president, yeah, who's the smartest man in the world. Like, he knows everything about everything. He really thinks that. So the incompetent people are actually incompetent, but they don't even know it. If you think you're incompetent, then that's the first step to actually go and get some help. Like, okay, I don't think I can do this. I need some help. And then the person you go for help might go, you know what? I want you to do it anyway. And if it goes wrong, it's cool. Yeah. And that's the best, that's a manager you want then. someone who will actually say, right, do it, and then we'll see how it goes. Yeah. And it's obviously, like, you know, depends on kind of what the task is, really. But people who are actually rubbish at their jobs don't even know it. And that's half the problem, because they think they're really good. And when you come to them and say, actually, the work's really bad, they're shocked. Yeah. Whereas in the reverse with the imposter, when you tell people their work is really good, they're embarrassed and they don't want to be complimented on it. Yeah. I thought that was a British thing. It really isn't. I think this is a thing with imposters, because it almost, by highlighting that you've done good work, that could actually, like, expose you for when you do bad work. Yeah. So someone's actually forced you to come out of the parapet and said, look at this person, he's done good work. And you're like, yeah, but this is the only thing I've done good, and the rest is really bad. When in reality, it's just not the case. And from experience, I've gone through so many disciplinaries. I've still gone through so many times where I've had to take people in rooms and said, like, this is, you know, we're going to have to part ways. None of them have been good. Yeah. Conversations. But none of those artists actually admitted that they were bad. Yeah. That the work was bad. They were all convinced that it was everybody else's problem. So it's, yeah.
I agree with you. I think for me, incompetence is really dependent on how you define incompetent. Incompetent for me means that you are not able or willing to acknowledge that you cannot learn, you cannot achieve your goal. Whereas if you realize that maybe you don't have the right tools, you don't have the right experiences, and you are willing to acknowledge that and go out there to find the tools and the resources that you need to make it happen, that doesn't make you incompetent. That makes you someone who's learning. That makes you someone who's growing. That makes you someone that will become good at whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. Maybe not perfect, but it means at the very least that you are not incompetent. So I think that it's very heavily dependent on how you define incompetence. And for me, that's much more tied to acknowledging that you don't know everything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. There's, you know, the wise man knows that he knows nothing. There's so many versions of that. And I always, when I feel like I'm like, oh yeah, it's going well, I'm like, remember, you don't know everything, and something's going to come up and you're not going to have the answer to it. And you just have to keep that in the back of your mind.
All right. We're almost through the questions that we have. So if you have any final question, now would be the time to ask it. So, one of the last questions that we have is, what are some techniques to help me build confidence in my work?
Okay. I guess it really depends, obviously, like, as an artist, like, it's showing your work to other people, and getting their feedback always, even in an unfinished state. And I think that can be applied to other things as well. You can only have, either good responses or responses that you can build on. Yeah. And the one thing that people find really hard, this is not necessarily imposters, but generally people find hard, is to separate themselves as a personality, as a human being, from the actual work. So if you're given a critique and it's not a great critique of your work and you've made mistakes, it's very easy to just think that's because you're a bad person, and that everybody hates you. And in reality, it's not that. It's because that piece of work wasn't very good. And they're not blaming you for that. They're just saying, here, it's not very good. Let's do better. Maybe you had a bad day. Everyone has a bad day. Sometimes with artists, you can tell, like, I've had some of the best artists, and you come to the desk at the end of the day and I go, how's it gone? And you see it and you go, woof. And I say to them, I was like, you had a bad day. And they're like, oh, I so did have a bad day. And they know it. Yeah. So it's all about getting feedback from people. and actually just exposing yourself to it. And it's really hard being imposter because you don't you want to show people stuff when it's done, when you made it perfect, where everything is perfect, and then go, here is my beautiful thing, and you've got to get out of that. Yeah, you've got to actually just show people as it's going. Here, I've done this, it's half done. Do you think it's in the right direction? And they'll be like, yeah, it is, or no, maybe we should change this. And you can course correct that.
I found out that it really helps to like caveat the parts that aren't done. So very explicitly, that's like, okay, I would like your feedback on this, but be aware that it's still a work in progress, especially this and this are parts that I'm still working on. So I would very much like your feedback on this part, because this part is the part that I feel is finished. Or in some cases, the exact opposite, and just ask for a very global feedback, like hint towards the kind of feedback that you're looking for, whether you're looking for just that. This is something that I do with a couple of my friends. I've mentioned this before. I have this friend group where we exchange feedback on a lot of the stuff that we do. And we default to every bit of feedback that's given is given on the topic content and not on the person, not on the individual giving that, writing that, or sharing whatever they want feedback on. And that, like, clarifying what kind of feedback you're looking for can really help you get feedback on what matters to you. And that can also help you build confidence in the parts that you're already certain of, or that you, for example, still have some doubts about. And I guess like another part is go out there and as Scott said, like get a lot of different bits of feedback. And what I found hard about getting feedback is that sometimes people don't really have the time or energy, or don't really know how you deal with feedback. So in those cases, start by giving. Start by thinking very closely about what kind of feedback you might have to help boost others' confidence, or how they could help improve. There are a lot of material out there about giving good feedback and then the way to give feedback, but giving feedback is a good place to start inviting feedback of your own. And with that, we are going to move on over to the last question. How do you go about finding the right challenge for you? So this ties into what we were talking about before, about figuring out what the challenges are that are important for you. Like, for example, Scott, you did in your journey.
Yeah, you have to really look inside and find out what motivates you, and what you thrive on, and that has to be, those things that you write down have to be really thought about as you're going through any interview process, or even starting to apply to a place. You have to really think about it. There's so many people who come through the door for an interview and they sit down and go, and you go, oh, so, you know, do you know much about the company and what we're doing? And they go, not really. And you're like, okay, well, why are we even here then? Yeah. And I mean, you don't necessarily want like people who are just like, okay, this is all I want to do, but they've got to be excited about what you're doing. Yeah. So you've got to find out what excites you. And that is just a kind of a long process of just deciding what you want to do, what your path is. Have a longer plan than just sort of what the next company you work for, or the next payrolls, or you know, some people chase this kind of like, okay, well, I've been here for 2.5 years, 3 years. Now, if I go somewhere else, I can get 10 more points, I can get another $15,000 on my paycheck here. And then they do that, and you can see it in people's CVs. But the people who you see that they went and they did a thing, And then the thing was either a success or was a failure, but they put their heart into it and they were committed to the thing. And then when you ask them in an interview, this was the, and they say, this was the reason I did that thing. This is the reason I moved here. And their story is the thing that excites you. So you have to decide what your long-term goals are. And it could be like, I don't want to ever work again. And I want to retire when I'm 40. But you need to have those goals. It could be like, I want to start my own company. And so everything I do should be based on that. And they've done research and they find that people who prioritize their own life goals and their career goals over the companies or their time at the companies actually benefits the company they work for anyway, because they become better employees, because they're looking to move up and do better. So they're committed to doing good work at the place they work. But you just have to really think, what I want my journey to be. Then when you write all those things down, you've got to hold them up against the place you're applying to or the thing you're doing next and go, does this do all the things on that list? And if it doesn't, you can go for the interview. You can go for the interview anyway and say, hey, you know what? This is really cool, but there's one thing I find that's missing from this. Can we talk about how this potential, because this is something that's a career goal. People are really open to that. People are like, oh, cool, you've got career goals. You've got things you want to do. That's exciting. And they will change. They're like, okay, well, you know, your role can be slightly different if we think there's a good fit. And you can go in with 80% and end up with 100% of what you want if you're open to just asking.
A lot of these questions resonate with me personally as well. I mean, as a fellow imposter, I've asked a lot of these questions. I've discussed them with a lot of people, and I think for me, I believe that everyone goes about finding their own meaning in a different way. I certainly can't say that I've entirely figured it out for myself, but what I can say, what helped me is defining my sort of top highest priority values, defining what I found to be the most rewarding for me, what makes me feel the most uncomfortable, because that for me is a sign that there is room for growth. And from there, just constantly reevaluate, have a trigger that makes you retro your life, and then keep adjusting course. There, it's not like in this world that's ever changing, our industry that's ever changing, we are ever changing. And that means that we no longer live in a world where you decide the course that you're gonna be on for the next 40 years. You're going to have to keep changing course. And that means that the right challenge now is going to be different from the right challenge in a week, in a month, in a year. So the only thing that I found to work right now is to just keep reevaluating, look at the challenges that are ahead of me, and figure out which aligns with my values, which aligns with what feels the most rewarding to me, which aligns with, honestly, what makes me feel the most uncomfortable, and what is going to give me the opportunity to grow the most. So that's how I would personally go, how I personally go about it.
Yeah, I agree, because your priorities do change. Yeah, and that's why that kind of list should be something that you look at every 6 months and go, is this still working for me? And if it's not, okay, can I change the things? And does that mean to change where I am? Because you'll end up in a different situation. You'll end up married, or you'll end up with children, or end up kind of a different part of the world. And then you kind of go, why is this not working for me? And then you have to kind of reassess.
Completely agree. And on that note, we are wrapping up. So Scott, thank you so much again for your time and perspective. I can assure you that it's been invaluable to me, and that it's probably been invaluable for many of us. As mentioned, this talk has been recorded and it's going to be published on the Game Production Podcast after a little bit of editing for some technical hiccups. We'd once again like to thank our wonderful supporters and our event producer, Kaz, in particular. So thanks, everyone.